our elected officials need to recognize that the second largest expense in any business and in a lot of homes is healthcare. It's just going to take some real bravery on behalf of the federal government to just kind of ratchet in what's become a system beyond control. And I don't know that it can be done at the state level. I think it needs to be done at the federal level.
Welcome to Up Next for Patient Safety. We continue conversations with the most interesting people doing important work toward our common goal of making healthcare safer, but also more reliable and even more satisfying for both patients and practitioners. I'm your host, Karen Feinstein, President and CEO of the Jewish Healthcare Foundation and the Pittsburgh Regional Health Initiative, which is a multi-stakeholder quality collaborative located here in my hometown, but with statewide, national, and even global links. We've been working to reduce medical error for 25 years, and I will say we never believed progress would be this slow. I do know that revolutions come from hope and not despair. I've found that these conversations inspire me with hope as we hear from safety leaders of distinction. This episode is part of a three-part series on the future of healthcare. We'll be joined by some notable futurists who will share their insights on where healthcare is heading and how to ensure that patient safety will be part of this future. Given the challenges facing healthcare today, many exacerbated by the pandemic, even if longstanding, we wanted to hear where these experts envision the industry moving toward a safer, more trustworthy future. In today's episode, we'll dig into some of the critical challenges facing the business of healthcare with Dr. Josh Luke, an expert who's had an insider's view into the industry and has something to say about how to make healthcare better while controlling costs. We'll also delve into one of the key drivers of both increased costs and poor patient outcomes, and that is avoidable hospitalizations. Dr. Luke has been CEO of four hospitals and is currently the CEO of North Kern South Tulare Hospital District in California. He has also previously founded the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative. Josh is a leading healthcare futurist, a Forbes contributor, and faculty for the University of Southern California's Saul Price School of Public Policy. He served as CEO of an acute rehab hospital, as a nursing home administrator, and as vice president of post-acute services for a health system, where he oversaw home health and hospice services. He's also authored several books, including Readmission Prevention, Solutions Across the Provider Continuum, Execute, a former hospital CEO tells all on what's wrong with American healthcare, and most recently, Health Wealth, 9 Steps to Financial Recovery. So welcome, Josh. These are provocative titles. I can't wait to get going.
Every time I hear that, I'm just reminded that I obviously can't keep a job for very long. So I appreciate you having me and just sharing that diverse background in healthcare.
Yeah, I can't wait to read Execute. So given the triple afflictions, and they're all interconnected, I think, facing healthcare now, one is workforce burnout, the low morale and exits among our current workforce. Second, the rise in medical errors. And the third, growing public mistrust. Give me one or two solutions you think would make a difference. And then tell me what is the likelihood that our health systems will put them in place.
Yeah, great question. I think if I were to name two things, I think transparency on behalf of the hospitals and health systems as it relates to pricing transparency. We're 3 or 4 years into a battle now of being required to post prices online so people can shop like they do for every other thing in our country. But it's been kind of a moving the cheese contest to just listing it in a way that's even more confusing than a regular person could understand. And so I just think the government's going to have to stay on that until it's something that the public can can understand. And that, so that would be number one, transparency. I think number two would just be the government getting more involved in price controls. And I know I'm a capitalist like most people are. I'm very pro-capitalistic society, but the reality is insurance companies raise their costs because hospitals raise their costs and everybody wins and pharmaceuticals raise their costs. And it's being passed on to corporate America and to the families, the employers. It's interesting growing up in the 80s as a Gen Xer and even in the 90s, you'd hear, oh, I have employee-based healthcare or commercial health plan, so I hardly pay anything. Well, you don't hear that statement anymore because every paycheck for a family, it's $500 or $600 coming out of their paycheck for their employee share. And so sooner or later, some of these CFOs are going to have to be bold enough to say enough is enough and really just take control over their healthcare spending, just like they would every other budget line item in their company. And you see a lot of these direct contracting deals popping up between health systems and employers. And I think you're going to see a lot more of that if you wanted a third tactic there.
I've often wondered why employers don't speak up. Why employers, who also have lobbyists and also have influence at policymaking levels, why they're not more outspoken on this topic of price controls. You know, what seems so obvious is that the patients and the employers by now would have risen up and said, we've got to do something about this mayhem, but it hasn't happened. So I spend a lot of time wondering, let me go to reducing readmissions, one of your areas of focus. Sometimes now there's even been some concern about whether a focus on reducing readmissions might have gone too far. We might be keeping people out of a hospital to keep, you know, our readmission rates down, when actually they needed to be readmitted. Talk a little bit about the most current perspective you have on reducing readmissions as a key to better outcomes of care.
Yeah, great question. And when we founded the National Readmission Prevention Collaborative back in 2013, it was still a new topic that most people hadn't heard about. It was introduced with the Obamacare, the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act 2010. And we founded our not-for-profit. You can still find that website at nationalreadmissionprevention.com if you want to learn more. But when we founded that, we knew so little about it. But what we learned so quickly is that the readmission penalty, the hospital readmission penalty, is intended to be punitive. After years of what those in the industry know to be called fee-for-service reimbursement, where Medicare or a company or an individual pays a fee for a service, a physician service, a hospital service, a nursing home service. It's basically a per diem. And so during that model, all the incentives for hospitals, for doctors, for nursing homes, for home health providers was just to run the score up, to give as much care as possible and bill, bill, bill. And we did that. And so what the government did in the Affordable Care Act was they put in a series of checks and balances to make sure that people weren't abusing that. And one of those checks and balances is called the hospital readmission penalty. And so it is intended to be punitive. And it basically said if people return to the hospital within 30 days of discharge, the hospital that originally discharged them is going to be penalized financially because we're going to assume they could have done a better job caring for them the first time they were there. So just on the surface, it appears to be punitive because it is. So that's number one. But what I really liked about your line of questioning is that you all are among the groups that have figured out that this is really about admission prevention, not readmission prevention. And what that means is the Affordable Care Act and the checks and balances that were put in place, and there's multiple, five or six of them at the time, were to make sure that we're not overutilizing. And that's a healthcare term for if a patient does not need to be in an acute hospital and can be cared for at a lower level of care, well, then do not admit them to the hospital because the prior method, fee-for-service, as we described, was not designed that way. It was designed to say, oh, you admitted them, we'll pay you whether or not they need it or not. So all of these checks and balances were just a way of really saying, pushing it down a little bit. Don't over-admit when you don't need to admit.
I'm very sympathetic to that. But one thing that readmission reduction and admission reduction requires is a strong network of primary care and skilled nursing and other institutional services in the community that are prepared to do interventions that prevent people arriving at the hospital and the ER. And, you know, right now I'm very disappointed at how little energy we're putting in to building a strong fabric of primary care, even though we know that it's fraying. And skilled nursing is another interesting issue. We had a big CMS grant to reduce readmissions from nursing homes and hospitalizations, period. It was so successful, we were one of the CMMI grants that got renewed. It wasn't that hard to do. But then again, you know, the funding for it, the staffing that you need at the skilled nursing or the the personal care level, what you need in terms of an adequate primary care network, I don't see much attention being given to that.
Yeah, I think your observations are right on, and congratulations about having that CMMI grant. Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, for those of you who may not know, was really the first time the feds came out and said, hey, we're going to recognize that you as providers probably know better than we do, so why don't we let you make the rules and design some delivery models for once, and we'll put aside some money to pay you to do that. And thank goodness they did, because we learned so much. And what came to mind as you asked me that question, first you asked about skilled nursing. What can they do to help prevent avoidable hospitalizations? The simple answer is communicate proactively with the hospital. It also serves as a marketing opportunity to just open doors and get more referrals from the hospital. So if somebody is going back to the hospital, don't hide from it and pretend like the hospital is not going to notice. Call and say, hey, we've done everything we can because we're looking out for you and for this patient. We don't know that this patient needs to be admitted to the hospital, but we tried everything on our end and they are coming back to the ED. So let us know what we can do. We didn't have the capability over here to rule out some things and you guys do. So don't assume they need to be admitted, but give us a call and let us know how it works out, because we're working for you to prevent avoidable hospitalizations. Number two, the second part of your question about hospital readmissions and how to prevent avoidable hospitalizations for hospitals, not nursing homes, it's just to reprogram your emergency department. Emergency department doctors are programmed to think that they are there to justify admitting patients who show up at the emergency room. And not only has that been proven, because that was the model for so long, but we also learned that patients, when they call 911, they expect to be taken to the hospital. And we learned that because some of these, again, CMMI pilot programs across the country where paramedics who finally had the opportunity, don't know if you've noticed, folks, but paramedics don't give care in the field. They basically put you in a gurney and get you to the hospital. They really were discouraged from and not allowed to give care in most cases, but just to get you quickly to the nearest emergency department. Well, there are some programs nationwide. There was one down in, I think it's Gilbert, Arizona, that was very successful. But these programs, what happens is they learn really quickly when people dial 911, they didn't want the paramedics to care for them in the field and tell them you don't need care. They expected to go to the hospital. So it's all of these perceptions of both physicians and patients that we need to overcome as we advance this discussion about not overutilizing and admitting people to the most appropriate level of care.
It's interesting. We did find in nursing homes that having a nurse available in the nursing home made a huge difference. And, you know, we're working on trying to get more geriatric nurses out there with a specialty in caring for seniors and just advanced practice nurses in general. So one of the things that I think has worked, we looked at how many people wound up being hospitalized because of problems with their medication. Problem could go either way. Too much, too little, wrong mix. But we put a pharmacist as an experiment in the ER, and it was dramatic. But when the grant money goes away, so does the pharmacist. And I don't know why. I think having a pharmacist in the ER is really a very good idea. I don't know. Do you have any perspective on that?
Yeah, I know of a very reputable hospital in Southern California that 6 or 7 years ago had a pharmacist and physician that specialized in palliative care come into the ED to help avoid hospitalizations. And they were doing very well. And 3 months in, I got a call from the doctor like, "Hey, Josh, you won't believe this, but they canceled our program and it was going so well." And I said, "Well, I believe it. I was waiting for you to call me and tell me that, because the hospital's source of revenue is admitting patients to the hospital from the ED. And for you to be in there preventing patients from getting admitted that probably did not need to get admitted, as you've proven, it's hurting their revenue. And because those calling the shots, the hospital CEOs, were more committed to the investors and their board of directors and revenue, that was natural." And so, as you've pointed out, pilot, a lot of people joke, is a word that just means nobody trusted the plan, so we're just going to pilot it and then put it to bed. And so a lot of times what happened is if there was a pharmacist put into the emergency department, it was more so for reconciling medications before a patient's sent home. Because as many of you know, a patient, when admitted to a hospital, shows up with 6 or 7 meds they were on at home. The hospital might not carry those meds or have them on their formulary, so they're prescribed entirely new ones. And then when they go to the nursing home, they don't have those same meds on their formulary, so they're prescribed entirely new ones, an average, I think, 7.5 or 8.5 meds per patient. And now, if you can just visualize, you have three different Ziploc bags full of 7 or 8 medications each, and you're not sure which ones to take. So you can understand why a patient would be nervous and have anxiety in that situation. So again, it just gets back to improving communication and just improved processes and shared technology when it comes to the hospital and the nursing home.
Yeah, and I mean, not that it's the least bit funny. We've also discovered the people go home with that Ziploc bag and then they take the same medication with different names because they already had medications at
Yeah.
home and they don't understand that they're actually doubling up.
That's exactly right.
So I look at medication mishaps, a lot of things you've named. By the way, what you just mentioned, we just funded a collaboration between Carnegie Mellon's technology experts and the people in biomedical informatics at the University of Pittsburgh to work on medication transfers from the hospital to different settings to see if we can't get better at doing this. We did a study a number of years ago. Why do people go in and out of hospitals? Who are these people? So we talked about medication errors. The one is that a number of the ambulance services don't get paid if they don't move you to the hospital. We have looked at experiments where the medics cared for people when they could easily in the field. They're very successful, but as you know, that can cost the ambulance service revenue. Let's talk about mental health and the number of people who actually are hospitalized because of mental health conditions that don't get treated during their hospitalization, and right now don't get treated in the community because of an acute, extreme shortage of resources.
Obviously, in the last 5 to 10 years, we've seen such an explosive growth of that. So it's been great to see that, these resources have finally come about. I was the CEO of the largest mental health hospital in Orange County, California, for several years, and so I saw firsthand how the mental health crisis is impacting our society. And then, we saw entire homeless villages pop up in areas where they never had them before. I teach healthcare policy at the University of Southern California. I saw that the mental health crisis was impacting even really affluent, young adults, millennials that were working in healthcare for good health systems. And just all of a sudden, the millennials and Gen Zs made it okay to embrace and acknowledge the fact that you're having some struggles with your mental health. Whereas for Gen Z, we really weren't allowed to do that, right? We were told to rub some dirt in it and get back in there. So it's been kind of inspiring and empowering for my generation to look at the millennial and Gen Zs and say, "Thank you for making it okay to admit that we all struggle with anxiety and at times mental health, And now we're putting some resources in place to do that. So I'm really encouraged by that. I don't know that we have all the answers quite yet, but whether it's in person, in a clinic, whether it's counseling or whether it's telehealth, I'm really encouraged by the money that's flowed into mental health support in recent years.
And may it increase. It's not enough, but I've also, like you, I've been very impressed at the peer-to-peer counseling success. And believe it or not, the counseling by a robot, the virtual counseling, you know, some things we've tried and I was very skeptical, but we are at least doing more to push the frontier. And particularly, I am amazed at how well people respond to school-based counseling. Unfortunately, our colleges cannot keep up with the demand, but I think bringing services out to the community, out to where people are for young people has made a big difference. So I'm listening to you and we know some of these things. We've experimented with them. We know that they work. We know that we could reduce hospitalizations, and we know that hospitalization itself is a comorbidity. What do you think, looking into the future, what is going to get our systems to respond? How do we set up a different set of incentives, which is keeping people as well as possible in the community, in the homes in which they want to live or apartments, should be the top priority? How are we going to get there? What will make the difference so that we stop doing all the things that aren't really in the best interests of the general population?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. And I think you've heard the cliche, if you've seen one model, you've seen one model, because not only is each community different, but each hospital and health system within those communities are doing things their own way as well. And even if you work for hospitals that are in a matrixed organization, the CEOs, they might be 5 miles apart, but the executives are going to have different ideas and different plans, and they're going to handle situations differently based on their culture. So it's just a matter of every system is doing it their own way, but they're figuring it out little by little. But the problem ultimately is the incentives in healthcare are still lined up. So insurers can raise rates every year, so their broker can get a higher commission, and the hospitals and health systems have no accountability in how they price their services. So until that's addressed, we're going to continue to see individual health plans and payers come up with their own models. And little by little, as much as they might work in their own markets, they're not necessarily universal. So it's going to take time.
Some of this seems so obvious to me, to you, to other people who look at this, you know, with their glasses on. I have a big question, though. What about all the initials, all of the healthcare specialty groups, associations in Chicago, in Washington? I've been to many of the headquarters. Isn't it time for them to speak up? I mean, on behalf of the public, maybe to say this kind of bloated system with money often in the wrong place and with the wrong incentives. I know a young person here who worked with us, was wonderful over a school year. She did great research working with the VA, but they told her that her desire, she was at the top of her class, her desire to be a family practice doc didn't fit with her level of acumen in medical school, and that she should take a year off to make sure that she wasn't making a big mistake in her life. And we loved her, she was terrific, but I am just asking this question, where are all the initials and why aren't all of these, I think America is uniquely rich in so many associations, specialty societies, why aren't they speaking up?
It's long overdue, but I think you mentioned it already, like they're sitting on each other's boards. By the time you get to that point in your life and your career, you're usually more financially stable. And so it's not as difficult for you personally to afford health benefits. It's just going to take some real bravery on behalf of the federal government to just kind of ratchet in what's become a system beyond control. And I don't know that it can be done at the state level. think it needs to be done at the federal level. You saw when they tried to limit profitability in the Affordable Care Act of different health conglomerates, that led to, you know, companies like Optum that have just become even bigger because they just go buy other companies that seem to have innovative models and keep their profitability down by reinvesting. And so it's kind of taken the problem and made it a different problem that's even bigger. And so we just need to keep at it. And our elected officials need to recognize that the second largest expense in any business and in a lot of homes is healthcare. And people need to realize the average American family, each year before they've seen one doctor or gotten one prescription, is paying out of pocket more than $23,000. For health insurance, for the right to go see the doctor or pick up their first prescription. When you do the math, a lot of people will hear that and go, oh, I'm lucky that's not me. Hold on, stop and do the math. $600 a paycheck twice a month or 26 times a year. We're getting up there now, aren't we? So then you add in your $5,000 deductible and all of a sudden, whoa, those numbers I just threw out you, that might be you. That is for the privilege of being able to go see a doctor once or pick up your first prescription. And if you're one of those people that still says, I'm very fortunate, my company provides healthcare, I think the last 30 seconds of your thought process realizing, whoa, I'm not that fortunate. The health policy that I have that costs my family more than 23 grand a year just for the right to go see a doctor and pick up a prescription has gotten out of control.
Playing off that, which we know to be true, some things are so ridiculous. If you go in for a B12 shot, you get a bill for hundreds of dollars. This is pretty ridiculous. What about the disruptors? We have some interesting players who are investing a lot. I mean, Amazon is one. They're investing a lot in doing something outside of the traditional legacy institutions. What hope do you hold there? Are they going to change our legacy institutions, or are they going to just sort of fail or be a side by side?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'm hopeful. I don't know that I'm confident. Amazon's already, I think this is their third bite at the apple, their third swing of the bat. I think they have started to deploy some clinics and started to do some hospital partnerships, things like that. So yeah, I think that's encouraging. I think we are going to get there slowly. I know Walmart, the clinics at Walmart have put some fear in people in the healthcare industry to say, are they going to be able to pull this off? And I think what we definitely have learned about Amazon, Walmart, and others getting into healthcare is, don't assume because it works here, it's going to work there. And I think they've realized that. And so they're slow to open a clinic in a different part of the country and then grow their services from there, as opposed to trying to put this blanket all across the country and do the same thing. So I think that's very important, but I think they are making progress. You know, the one thing they can do that we've started to see is direct primary care, where if you have you know, a couple thousand employees that report to the same parking lot every day, whether it's one company or three companies in that same parking lot, why not put a physician office in there and pay them directly to see your patients? It's going to improve your efficiency and your productivity at work as well, because people aren't having to leave to go to the doctor every day. So it's concepts like that, that little by little, we're going to start to get an improved delivery model.
Well, let's talk about technology. I go to a very inspired, I think, eye doctor, eye surgeon, and he has found that there are a lot of things related to your vision testing that are not only mobile now, they're sort of lightweight mobile. You could take them out to where people are instead of having everyone make an appointment and come for us either downtown or out to one of our big health medical centers. That you can bring a lot of services out to where people are. Do you hold much hope for that?
Yeah, but it's taking time. It's a slow troll, you know. I wrote about that in my book, Health Wealth, 9 Steps to Financial Recovery. Just talking about direct primary care, gut testing, to get your gut tested so you can, you really need to take charge of your own healthcare is the point of most of these things we're talking about. I call it becoming an EHC, an engaged healthcare consumer. And by doing that, get your genome sequenced and understand what foods are going to be fuels for your body, what foods are going to be blockers, pharmacogenetics, understanding which medications your body metabolizes better, going to direct primary care where you can see a physician. And, you know, a lot of people haven't realized, especially if they're Gen X or baby boomers or even of the greatest generation, there's really no such thing as a, you know, personal family physician anymore. And the exception to that, my family has one, is the direct primary care, where you just pay the doctor directly, whether you have insurance or not, and he or she gives you access to them 24/7, either via the telephone or telehealth or via text. So it's all these things that little by little we see creeping into society, because those of us in the know that this can be done better.
Well, you raise an interesting issue, so you'll tell me how you feel about this. I was on a study tour to the Pacific Rim, to some very sophisticated countries, and I was shocked. They said, no, we do specialty care, very low cost, no cost, but we charge for primary care because we think people have to take responsibility for their health. And, you know, you can't even say that in the U.S. I mean, that'd be like the least woke thing you could possibly say. But these are highly sophisticated countries who say, we want people to be responsible. And in some ways, I saw that they make it easy. You've worked in so many different settings. Talk to me a little. What are we going to do about the morale of our healthcare workers? I got to look at the satisfaction surveys in a large system for the doctors and nurses. I thought I knew that people weren't happy. I didn't know they were this unhappy. And when you look at 48% of physicians who say they wish they'd chosen a different career, how are we going to inspire people to love their work? How are we going to get these well-trained and I think committed professionals to say, I find my day satisfying?
Yeah, you know, again, that's a complicated answer, but, you know, most caregivers got into caregiving because they wanted to make a difference, so they had a personal story. And you made a statement earlier that I was going to inject on, that I will now, which is this. You referred to nursing home, and you said, I don't know if people caught it, but you said, we got funding to put a nurse in a nursing home, and you hit it on the head of the nail. We should actually call nursing homes CNA homes, because there's only two nurses in the whole place. And only one of them is a registered nurse. The other one's an LVN or an LPN, depending on what state you're in. And both of them are doing nothing but charting or passing meds the whole time. In fact, one usually passes meds while the other charts, and then they reverse roles. And the reason there's only two is because that's the minimum required for an owner to staff to meet the staffing requirements. So 95% of the care being given in a nursing home is being given by a certified nurse assistant. And their, you know, patient ratios can be 15, 16 to 1 in a nursing home. In a hospital, it's more like 6 to 1. But you find that these CNAs, who oftentimes, you know, didn't go to college or may or may not be high school graduates, but have a caregiver's heart, are just being run ragged and being disrespected. And I wish I had an answer for that question, because it is going to take more than money. The pandemic really brought this to the surface for a lot of reasons, but one of them is because every nurse realized that they could go triple their income to go work somewhere else, even if it was part-time or temporary on a contract. And a lot of them did. They lost that loyalty because they saw financially how they could benefit. And so they went and worked contract labor, and it started to come back under control. But again, the pandemic really brought the anxiety level up, and the contentness of caregivers to probably an all-time low.
I'd certainly say that I don't right now. I mean, I see the data, but what I don't see is a commensurate response. Am I missing something? I don't get the sense that this is top of mind at our health systems right now.
I just don't know how much they can do at health systems beyond, you know, good pay rates, celebrating and honoring their caregivers as often as they can. The reality is, you know, hire more staff and make your ratio lower. But that just gets to the bottom line, so it's difficult to do. So, yeah, so it's a tough one, that's for sure. Everybody's struggling with it across the whole country.
Well, I can say this. You see things clearly, and you don't just dwell on, ain't it awful? You have some very practical solutions. How are you going to get your voice heard, and where do you want it heard? Where could more people listen to some of these solutions and get action?
It's a great question. I'm really active on LinkedIn at Dr. Josh Luke on LinkedIn, and have been for several years. I do a lot of newsjacking or sharing relevant healthcare stories. And I just launched my third healthcare podcast. The first two were ranked top 10 healthcare podcasts in prior years.
And I can't thank you enough. This has been an interesting romp. We have an expression, from your lips to God's ears. And I don't know who God is in this respect, but I certainly wouldn't mind if it hit DC and the policymakers. So thank you so much.
Thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Up next for Patient Safety is a production of the National Patient Safety Board Coalition in partnership with the Pittsburgh Regional Health Initiative and the Jewish Healthcare Foundation. It's hosted by me with enormous production support from Scotland Huber and Lisa George. This episode was edited and engineered by Jonathan Kersting and the Pittsburgh Technology Council. Special thanks also to Lisa Boyd, Carolyn Burns, and Robert Ferguson for their ongoing assistance. Special thanks also to Ariana Longley and Lauren Payne for helping with the series. Thank you for listening, and please take action, whatever you can do, to advance patient safety.